Good evening, everybody. Good evening again. And it's my pleasure to welcome Susanna Clapp, furthest away from me, Hattie Morahan, closest to me, and Di Spears in the middle, to Small Wonder, in an event that celebrates the life and work of the incomparable novelist and short story writer, Angela Carter. Di Spears, who'll chair this session, is editor of Readings, BBC Radio. That seems a very modest title for someone who's responsible for commissioning more short stories for the radio than any other media produces, as well as adapting a constant flow of literary fiction for broadcast. Di was chair of the Orange New Writers Award and has been judged for several short story prizes, including the Asham, which has a connection with Charleston. Di was one of the people responsible for launching the BBC Short Story Award in 2006 and has always since then sat on the judging panel. Most importantly, Di is a long-term supporter of Small Wonder and participant in the festival. And just one more thing before I hand over to Di. Di will introduce Susanna and Hattie, but I'd just like to mention that if Hattie's version of The Tiger's Bride varies very slightly from the one with which you're familiar, it's because it's been especially adapted for this evening by Richard Hamilton Jones, and we're very grateful for his expertise, and I happen to know he's in the audience. Thank you, and I'm very happy to hand over to Di.
Well, thank you, and it's lovely to be back. I worked out this was my sixth time at Small Wonder, so it's lovely to be here, and it feels like home, really, coming back here. And it's a great privilege to be on the platform tonight with a wonderful actress who's a great reader, who we've worked together several times now, and with Susanna, who has written a very interesting, informative, and really illuminating book about Angela Carter, and encapsulated in a few small moments, I think, so much of her life. It's a sort of a perfect book for a short story festival. Susanna is the Observer's theatre critic, and she's also written a book about Bruce Chatwin. She's the literary executive for both Bruce Chatwin and for Angela Carter, and her book about Angela is called A Card from Angela Carter. And they're on sale outside afterwards. Hattie Morahan is an actress who's fresh from playing Nora in A Doll's House at the Young Vic, to enormous acclaim, and is about to portray Helen Thomas, the wife of Edward Thomas, in a new play about Edward Thomas, which will be starting at the Almeida in a month. It's in rehearsal at the moment. What we'll do is I'm going to talk to Susanna first about Angela's life and her work, and then Hattie will read from The Tiger's Bride. Susanna, I mentioned this is a book based around the postcards that Angela sent you over a period of about 12 years. So very appropriate for here, because these are small missives, but they tell a much bigger story than perhaps the number of words allotted to them. And I thought we should really just start with why the postcards triggered you to write this book.
Well, I think postcards interest me very much because they always tell more than one story. I mean, there's the image and there's a message on the back. And sometimes these complement each other, sometimes they contradict each other. And importantly, from a biographical point of view, the history of postcards, it's quite difficult to recover the impetus behind those messages in years to come. 20 years later, nobody will know, probably, that an image was chosen because either consciously, the sender knew that it referred to a conversation they had with the person they were sending it to, or something that they shared together. And of course, there's much less biographical information on a postcard, often no salutation, often no address. So they're sort of rather mysterious, and they seem to me very compact and very Angela-like, because they're almost like emblems. And this was a writer who was very influenced by medieval literature, which she, to some people's surprise, studied at university. It was a special subject. And she was very interested in the idea of emblematic material. Now, that's the high-flown explanation, which is a true explanation, but there's a more pragmatic explanation, which is they were what I had. I am her literary executor. We met when I was helping to set up the London Review of Books. And I, after her death, went round her house in Clapham, went round her study in Clapham, to the first time. I knew the house quite well. I'd been there many times. I'd sat in the kitchen and the sitting room downstairs, which was, for anybody who knows Angela's work, redolent with her spirit and her style, purples and marigolds on the walls, a kite hanging from the sitting room ceiling, birds left wheeling round the room, a cat looking rather balefully at the words, muddle and glory and carnival. The study, which I'd never been to, was completely different. Cranial, not carnival. A sober, more 50s style. A little plain wooden desk looking out over the window in Clapham. And a filing cabinet stuffed with often scripts that hadn't been produced, and drafts of her work. Of course, I hoped I was going to find a missing novel or, you know, a batch of short stories, and of course I found nothing of that kind. I did find some unproduced works, which have been collected in her collected works, but it made me think about what I myself had. I went back and I found something which is now on my mantelpiece, a little mechanical doll, one of those wind-up Russian dolls, tin, that goes scudding across the room when you turn the key. Very Angela-like, very Russian, little pink cheeks, painted frock and so on. And I found these cards. I mean, I had some letters, but they were almost falling apart. These cards seemed to me to catch Angela. They were on the wing, apparently sent spontaneously without much thought. Often they very much captured her prose, but very, very much captured her visual sense. And we'll hear when Hattie reads how absolutely... Helen Simpson said it very well. Helen Simpson said she's an abstract thinker with an intensely visual imagination. I think that's a very, very unusual combination, but it's exactly what it is. And these cards capture some of that, and I think they tell us more about her work than you'd actually suspect.
And you talk about carnival in her house, and one of those cards is called Carnival, isn't it? And it's wonderful. It's a sort of very extraordinary image of these men walking along.
It's very interesting. You're talking about the card, which is a black and white card, but it nevertheless seems to contain a lot of riot and colour in it. It's of the Pleasanttown Carnival in California, and it shows men who are half in and half out of their costume, and they're not dandies. On the contrary, they have what we would now call man breasts, a lot of them. They're rather overweight, slightly uneasy in their carnival, not tremendously attractive, and you can't quite tell where their bodies begin and the carnival costume ends, because the carnival costume, the thing is that the carnival costume hangs from their waists, so that they start all over again from their waists. In other words, the collars are here, then you see their chests. And when they're fully in carnival fig, great toppers cover the whole of their upper torso. You can see that from characters in the back. Now, the point about this is that Angela, who she sent it from, might have been Austin, Texas, I'm not quite sure, no, it wasn't, somewhere in the States, where she often taught as a creative writing person. She was very interested in the States, sometimes very opposed to its politics, but very fascinated by the energy of it and the mix of it and the movement of it. And she was also fascinated by carnival. Why? Because, and it's absolutely central to her work, I think, and it's, of course, central to Fairy Tale, which we're talking about now, she was fascinated by things that were changing, that were almost one thing and almost another, and where sometimes you couldn't tell the difference. For example, she wrote very much in her wonderful journalism about women's fashion. Rather a surprise, and actually rather a surprise, as I was saying earlier, if you actually met her, because she was the first woman I knew who let her hair go grey, and not only let her hair grow grey, but let her hair go bushy in the most sort of amazing way. She wore, I remember somebody saying when she went to Glyndebourne that her favourite garb was a very, very baggy woolen sweater. And one of those sort of tartan full skirts and possibly boots. In other words, she was absolutely not a fashion plate. What interested in her was what interested her was the idea of women making themselves up. I mean, not just in makeup, but the way we construct ourselves. In other words, the journalism that she wrote, and I feel passionately about it because that was how I knew her particularly, and I think that her journalism is as important, funnily enough, as her creative writing. Oh, actually, let me rephrase that. Her journalism is creative writing.
Why do you say that?
Well, for two reasons. One was she herself said, she trained, by the way, she went to university late. Before that, she was apprenticed to the Croydon Advertiser. And she said,
her father was a journalist.
Her father was a journalist, and it was her father who got her the job, or who, you know, made the introduction. And she said that she had a demon in accuracy, so that she couldn't actually be a reporter. She had to go on to write features. And so there was, in that crude way, a creativity about her way with facts. But I also think that she wrote so empoweringly when she wrote about clothes, about makeup, about places, about books, about almost anything that one could mention. And her range was enormous. I mean, she was the only person when I was on the London Review whom you could absolutely confidently say, well, you know, it's Colette, or it's Louise Brooks, or it's the ANC, or it's food, which we'll perhaps come to in a minute, or it's Herman Melville, or, you know, huge range. We'll give it to Angela. She could do anything. Freudianism, fantastically funny attack. Why was it creative? It was creative because the use of language was so exact, so rich, so energetic, so generating power. That seems to me a definition of creativity. It bred creativity in the reader as well.
And is it possible to read much of her journalism now?
A bit, yes. There are two. I should know, and I can't remember how many selections are in print. There's certainly an excellent selection called Nothing Sacred, which I urge anybody to read. It has, again, it shows this range. It has a wonderful essay, for example, on Bath, where Angela, rather surprisingly in some ways, to those of us who think of it as a genteel city, spent her time. And the most beautiful description, both of the particular light of that place, but also of Bath as inhabited by a city of mad people. It's quite, you know, surprising. That was she always caught you on the hop. But then also these essays about her upbringing, essay, for example, in which she compares her grandmother to St. Pancras Station. And also about books, everything. It's all there. Very, very, very well worth getting, I think.
And do you think it was... And one of the reasons, I mean, she's a superlative short story writer and she crams an incredible amount into a short story. Is that partly a journalist's training, do you think? Or did they go hand in hand? Did she... Obviously, the journalism was fed by her creative side.
It's interesting. I hadn't quite thought of that. I think it did... Her journalist training certainly did help her. I think, actually, her strongest suit was not construction of plot. Interestingly enough, one of the things I found when I was looking through her study was that she'd written poems, which I hadn't realised. She left some journals, which were partly working notebooks and partly notes, so that there were long lists of films, long lists of things that she was reading. Very rarely novels. I mean, she did read novels, but they were much more books of about witches or recipe books, sort of thing. I think that there was a journalistic element to what she did, but I think also the point was that she, although she was interested in story, it wasn't large architectural planning that was her strong suit. She was much better on the short burst. And when you look at the poems, which are really, really interesting, there's one in my book, so you'll have to buy it, you see, that you can see already that it was a richness of language, a sense of capturing what was around her, a sensuality that was very important to her. And I think it sometimes makes a tremendous short story writer, and it sometimes makes her novels wonderful, but not exactly page-turning. I mean, you get to the end of the page, and it's wonderful, and you glory in it, and then you take a deep breath, and there's the next page. And it's not, I mean, it's not like reading Geoffrey Archer, for one.
Let's put it that way. No.
You wouldn't confuse the two.
No, and I think a lot of people think her short stories will be the literary work that lasts, that The Bloody Chamber will be the book that is the most remembered.
Well, I think, I mean, there are good reasons for perhaps supposing that, and we might even say a bit more about that later, but I think it become apparent when Hattie reads. The reason for thinking that it's tremendously important is quite simple. They were revolutionary. She didn't produce variations on fairy tale. She remade, she took the elements of fairy tale and created new stories from them. And she made us look, I think, completely anew at the stories that we pipe into our innocent children's ears late at night. She showed that they were frightening, violent, that they constrained people, particularly women. But she would argue, as I think any good feminist would, that if you constrain women, you constrain men as well. She wasn't doctrinaire and ridiculous about it. And she thought that by recharging these ingredients, she could give women a way of, give everybody a way of empowering themselves, but a way also of looking lushly and freshly at the world. There's a very interesting interview with Jenny Murray. It's a real, you can get it on YouTube, and it's really worth hearing, because apart from anything else, Jenny Murray sounds about 23.
Probably very posh in those days.
They were both quite posh, and it's very interesting because you can hear Angela's voice.
Which we were talking about earlier.
Interesting. Which I'll describe in a second, but what's interesting about that is they're talking, it was when she was editing one of the Virago Book of Fairy Tales. She edited two Virago Books of Fairy Tales, which were fairy tales from all over the country, so Eskimo fairy tales, Inuit fairy tales, and Indian fairy tales, and tales from, Czechoslovakian, as it then was, and so on. And Jenny Murray asks her why she wanted to work on fairy tale, and Angela says, "Well, you know, we need more heroines." And Jenny Murray says, "But you know, we've got, you know, the traditional fairy tales are full of heroines. I mean, look at Cinderella, for example." And Angela says, "Yeah, but you know, Sleeping Beauty. You wouldn't really say she was a figure with much get up and go." That's what she was like.
Yes.
You know? And that's what she remade. The funny thing about her voice, and it's really interesting for anyone who has read her work, because it's so surprising, is that here is one of the most gutsy, frank, I think fearless, really, really fearless writers of the 20th century. And I'm sorry, she wasn't in the 21st century, which she should be. Don't let's forget, she died 20 years ago. She was only born in 1940. That she was fearless both in her subject matter and in her use of language and in her variety and what she said and in the forthrightness of her politics. She wasn't afraid of appearing solemn. Well, she didn't have any... She wouldn't have been one of these women who nowadays said, I wouldn't call myself a feminist, but, you know, none of that. She was right out there, but also with this tremendous, raunchy, rolling, life-enhancing sense of humour. But when you hear her voice, it's very odd because it's quite high-pitched and it's quite... I'm smiling here because I have to say that one of her great friends, one of her oldest friends, who happens to be a Charleston guide, actually, is in the audience. She was at university with her, so it's very moving to me to see her hair, and she did nod. So I'm, you know, checking from time to time if she does nod. Anyway, she had this sort of strange little piping voice that was half genteel. I mean, it was genteel. The vowels were slightly sliced. You know, nowadays, I'm sure more writers would put on a kind of faux streetwise voice, you know, just to show that they were really sort of down with the kids kind of thing. Not Angela, but of course it was very subtle, because was that gentility really a terrible irony that she was practicing on you? Was it a sort of parody of gentility? And I sort of think it was both, because what she always was contradictions. I mean, this is why the postcard is so interesting.
I was going to say, there's a very interesting postcard from Australia, isn't there, it's an Edwardian scene on an Australian beach with a mother and the child, the boy, and of course she had a son, didn't she, Alexander, has a son. Which is, that's a postcard about motherhood and about politics.
To me, it
looks like a very, it looks like a, you know, a very beautiful sort of image of a time lost. But I wonder why she chose that.
Well, I mean, of course, I don't know. This is my speculation. But it, this was one of, to me, the most. I'm glad you mentioned that one because it is to me one of the most, the ones that's most dear to my thesis, as it were. Because it's, as you say, it's a postcard by an Australian painter, very traditional Edwardian postcard of a young mother in a long white royal dress on a beach. And in the background, you can see people frisking with boaters and holding their dresses up and slightly probably flirting, a little frisky waves and the sun. And she's toweling down a child, and you can see the child's little bottom and cheek just glowing with the sun. And it's an idyll. Now, this was written when, soon after Angela, she was a late mother. She was 42 when she had her son, I think. And that, which would then, of course, was even more unusual than perhaps now. And I like to see that. I think that she was drawn to that card because she was a very, very doting mother. She said, "Oh, Alexander took us by surprise." And of course, in some sense, that can't entirely be true. But I think that her great love for him did take her by surprise and actually overwhelmed her. And it was very wonderful to see her together with him. And so I think that her card, that she was drawn to that card because of that, and also because she was interested in that period. This is what I mean about unpacking postcards. You know, sometimes it's not really evident why somebody would send an image, but if you happen to know, you can work it out.
But they're very eclectic, aren't they? I mean, there's a Texan chili. You know, there's a Texan chili one, which is, couldn't be more different.
So exactly. And I'll do what I would just say about, just to finish the Edwardian one, is that on the back of it, this is what I mean by the contradiction, is her. I see this as a card of two utopias. One is the utopia of domestic life, of love, maternal love, and, you know, love with your family. On the other side is Angela's other side, which is her love of socialistic utopia. And she says, some of these cards say very little, by the way, but some of them say quite a lot. And she says, my theory at the moment is that Australia is the history of the British working class on a hugely magnified scale. In other words, I can't remember exactly what she says, but she says something like, the despised and the rejected go out there, and then in two generations' time, with a few exceptions, and she mentions somebody, but I have not said that person's name, they turn out to be tall, incredibly good-looking, and Republican. And what I love about that is it's the intimacy on one side and the softness and the outspokenness and the grand scale on the other. But, as you say, there is his other card, which I'm very fond because it relates to journalism. So I know that it was meant for, well, obviously it was meant for me, which is a card of Texan chili. And it's an absolutely terrifying card because, I mean, in a mild way, of a recipe for Texan chili with this terrible cauldron of very, very bright red meat with sort of blue steam coming off it and beans beside it. It looks really absolutely like the sort of thing you never want to meet. On the back of it, it says, Carter's reply to the critics. I'd like to feed it to that drivelling wimp, ... Again, I've taken the name out because I think that drivelling wimp is still alive. He's all right, actually. Preferably through his back passage. That's very Angela-like. And the point about that was that it was a response to some ferocious letters which had been written about a review she wrote for us on the London Review, which was an attack on foodies who were just coming into their own. And she reviewed the foodie handbook, a book by Elizabeth David and the Chapinese cookbook at the same time. And she was, in some sense, morally offended by these books coming out at a time when there was a terrible Ethiopian famine. And it wasn't, by the way, they were quite wrong in saying she didn't like cooking and didn't like eating. But she didn't like the what she called the finicking obsession with food. By the way, people went on and on about lettuce leaves while then switching on the television and seeing somebody dying in front of them. She said that, That was quite a courageous thing to say, because it was an unfashionable thing to say, which is more courageous than saying things which are more obviously courageous, if you see what I mean. And my goodness, she got absolutely clobbered for it on the letters pages. I mean, somebody, they called her a Puritan, they called her a prig. Somebody said she shouldn't be in charge of a pram. They knew she was pregnant, let alone a kitchen knife. All this sort of thing. So that was what that card was in response to. It's very interesting to me, the cooking thing, because, A, she did like cooking. She was tremendously sensual, and she liked cooking. I remember her sitting in her kitchen with a cat on her lap, cooking, I think it was rabbit and apricot, something like that. And also, I think there's something very interesting in terms of somebody who's interesting about fairy tale in her relation to food, which was that when she was a late teenager, she was anorexic. And she was anorexic, and she said she was completely forthright about it. She said that it was an attempt to gain control of her life from over-possessive parents, which seems a classic textbook definition of anorexia. But I've always thought that, I'm sure somebody's written a PhD about it, because people are always writing PhDs about Angela, that it's very interesting that somebody who was so interested in fairy tale, who has so many in fairy tale being stuffed with form-changing, shape-changing, little, big, magic spells, trying to get control, should have been an anorexic. I mean, I feel that there's an almost physical, visceral bond between the two things. By the way, when she chose her book for Desert Island Discs, which she'd got it all, the Desert Island Discs worked out, but she died before it could be recorded. She said because John Major, who was then the Prime Minister, had pushed her off her slot. Whether that was perhaps the BBC but will tell us. I don't know.
I can't answer the BBC.
Anyway, when she chose her book for Desert Island Discs, it was La Russe Gastronomique, which would have surprised most people who knew her, who would have expected her to choose, I don't know, Marcuse or Foucault or a great novel or something. And she said, we did ask her why. I mean, somebody must have asked, the researcher probably asked her why. And she said she chose it because it was a good read. And actually, it is a good read, in fact. But it took somebody like Angela to point that out. By the way, when she was on the London Review, she wrote a cracking piece for us about the potato, the history of the potato. And she called it, she called it that godless vegetable, the potato. It's just so, so wonderful. Anyway. Mm.
We must move on, I think, to the Tiger's Bride now. But it is worth saying her whole memorial service was structured, wasn't it, around Desert Island Discs or what she had chosen for it.
And by the way, unfortunately, there isn't actually a card, but I slightly cheated in my book, and we used the introduction to the memorial service, which was designed by her great friend Corinna Sargood, who illustrated her books of fairy tales, and they are very wonderful, and they do reveal what her luxury was, which was rather a surprise.
Not a tiger.
No.
I wanted to ask you one question about particularly her obsession, I think, or her interest in one fairy tale, which is Beauty and the Beast, which really she rewrote in four different forms, including the story that we're about to hear. And I wondered why she kept... I mean, do you think that is also to do with transformation, Beauty and the Beast? It's all certainly about the power relationship with parents, isn't it? And power with a controlling or a hapless father, but the father figure within that relationship.
Yes, you're right. I think it is transformation partly. I mean, this is the Tiger's Bride, Chatty's going to read. It talks to another story called The Courtship of Mr. Lion in this, and in both stories end with a transformation. I mustn't say what this one is, but in the other, the Beast. It was a sort of reworking of Beauty and the Beast, ends with the Beast being changed in some way. So I think it's partly that. She was very interested in sex, and she wrote about it very freely. And this has a lot to do with that. Of course, she was one of the early books published by Virago, which was founded by her great friend Carmen Khalil, was The Sardian Woman, which was written by Angela, which was about her interest in de Sade. I mean, and, you know, what his fantasies about women told us about women and women's complicity with them. So that was very important. I think that, in a way, all those things make it sound much more abstract and dogmatic and theoretical than it really is, because what it is also about is about, when we were talking about that carnival card, about something where you don't quite know whether it's flesh or fabric. You don't quite know, she talked about this in architecture as well, whether something's marble or a pastiche. And you sometimes don't know, like her voice, was it real or was it ironic? And you often didn't know that. And this is the same with her prose. Is it taking something off or is it actually the thing itself? What it certainly is absolutely lush and gorgeous, and to do with stripping away layers, both in a sort of metaphorical and a physical sense, so that you get to a truth beneath the surface, while not forgetting that the surface itself is also a kind of truth. I mean, that's what she was so brilliant about, putting all these things together and making you feel all these things simultaneously.
And I think that's a perfect note on which to listen to the story. So a slightly shortened, but not very much shortened, version of The Tiger's Bride. Thank you, Hattie. Thank you.
The Tiger's Bride. My father lost me to the beast at cards. There's a special madness strikes travellers from the north. When they reach the lovely land where the lemon trees grow. We come from countries of cold weather. At home, we are at war with nature, but here, ah, you think you've come to the blessed plot where the lion lies down with the lamb. Everything flowers. No harsh winds stir the voluptuous air. The sun spills fruit for you. But then the snow comes. You cannot escape it. It followed us from Russia as if it ran behind our carriage, and in this dark, bitter city has caught up with us at last, flocking against the window panes to mock my father's expectations of perpetual pleasures, as the veins in his forehead stand out and throb, his hands shake as he deals the devil's picture books. The candles dropped hot, acrid gouts of wax on my bare shoulders. I watched with the furious cynicism peculiar to women whom circumstances force mutely to witness folly, while my father, fired in his desperation by more draughts of the firewater they call grappa, rids himself of the last scraps of my inheritance. How he laughs as if with glee as he beggars himself. He is in such a passion to donate all to the beast. Everyone who comes to this city must play a hand with the grand seigneur. Few come. They did not warn us at Milan, or if they did, we did not understand. Indeed, I myself spoke up in favour of this remote provincial place, out of fashion 200 years, because, oh irony, it boasted no casino. I did not know that the price of a stay in its decembral solitude was a game with milord. The hour was late. The chill damp of this place creeps into the stones, into your bones, into the spongy pith of the lungs. It insinuated itself with a shiver into our parlour, where milord came to play in the privacy essential to him. Who could refuse the invitation his valet brought to our lodging? Not my profligate father, certainly. The mirror above the table gave me back his frenzy. The coloured tide of the cards as they rose and fell. The still mask that concealed all the features of the beast, but for the yellow eyes that strayed now and then towards myself. La bestia, said our landlady, gingerly fingering an envelope with his huge crest of a tiger rampant on it, something of fear, something of wonder in her face. And when she saw me, che bella. Since I could toddle, always the pretty one, with my glossy nut-brown curls, my rosy cheeks, and born on Christmas Day. Her Christmas rose, my English nurse called me. The peasants said the living image of her mother, crossing themselves out of respect for the dead. And the beast gave me the rose from his own impeccable, if outmoded, buttonhole when he arrived. This white rose, unnatural, out of season, that now my nervous fingers ripped petal by petal apart, as my father magnificently concluded the career he had made of catastrophe. My senses were increasingly troubled by the fuddling perfume of Milord, far too potent a reek of purplish civet at such close quarters in so small a room. I never saw a man so big look so two-dimensional. In spite of the quaint elegance of the beast, he has an odd air of self-imposed restraint, as if fighting a battle with himself to remain upright when he would far rather drop down on all fours. Only from a distance would you think the beast not much different from any other man, although he wears a mask with a man's face painted most beautifully on it. Oh, yes, a beautiful face, but one with too much formal symmetry of feature to be entirely human. He wears a wig, too, false hair tied at the nape with a bow, and gloves of blonde kid that are yet so huge and clumsy they do not seem to cover his hands. He is a carnival figure, made of papier-mâché and crepe hair, and yet he has the devil's knack with cards. His masked voice echoes as from a great distance as he stoops over his hands, and he has such a growling impediment in his speech that only his valet, who understands him, can interpret for him, as if his master were the clumsy doll and he the ventriloquist. The wick slumped in the eroded wax. The candles guttered. By the time my rose had lost all its petals, my father, too, was left with nothing. Except the girl. Gambling is a sickness. My father said he loved me, yet he staked his daughter on a hand of cards. He fanned them out. In the mirror, I saw wild hope light up his eyes. A queen, a king, an ace. I saw them in the mirror. Oh, I know he thought he could not lose me. Besides, back with me would come all he had lost, the unravelled fortunes of our family at one blow restored. And would he not win as well? The beast's hereditary palazzo outside the city, his immense revenues, his treasure chest, his mantegnas. You must not think my father valued me at less than a king's ransom, but at no more than a king's ransom. So we teetered on the brink. The beast bayed, laid down all the three remaining aces. The indifferent servants now glided smoothly forward, as on wheels, to douse the candles one by one. To look at them, you would think that nothing of any moment had occurred. They yawned a little resentfully. It was almost morning. The beast's man informed me crisply that he, the valet, would call for me in my bags tomorrow at 10 and conduct me forthwith to the beast's palazzo. Where my father had been red as fire, now he was white as the snow that caked the window pane. His eyes swam. Soon he would cry. I have lost my pearl. My pearl beyond price. At that, the beast made a sudden dreadful noise. The quick valet interpreted unblinkingly. My master says, if you are so careless of your treasures, you should expect them to be taken from you. He gave us the bow and smile his master could not offer us, and they departed. I watched the snow until just before dawn it stopped falling. Next morning, there was a light like iron. The beast's carriage was black as a hearse, and it was drawn by a dashing black gelding. The valet sat up on the box. clasping, of all things, a bunch of his master's damned white roses, as if a gift for flowers would reconcile a woman to any humiliation. He sprang down with a preternatural agility to place them ceremoniously in my reluctant hand. My tear-beslobbered father wants a rose to show that I forgive him. When I break off a stem, I prick my finger, and so he gets his rose all smeared with blood. The valet crouched at my feet to tuck the rugs about me with a strange, unflattering obsequiousness. I drew the curtains to conceal the sight of my father's farewell. My spite was sharp as broken glass. Lost to the beast. And what, I wondered, might be the exact nature of his beastliness. My English nurse once told me about a tiger man she saw in London. They'd brought him from Sumatra, she said. His hinder parts were all hairy, and only from the head downwards did he resemble a man. And yet the beast goes always masked. It cannot be his face that looks like mine. But the tiger man, in spite of his hairiness, could take a glass of ale in his hand like a good Christian and drink it down. But if this young lady was not a good little girl and did not eat her boiled beetroot, then the tiger man would put on his big black travelling cloak lined with fur, just like your daddy's, and hire the Earl King's galloper of wind and ride through the night straight to the nursery and, yes, my beauty, gobble you up. How I'd squeal in delighted terror, half believing her, half knowing that she teased me. We had left the city far behind us and were now traversing a wide, flat dish of snow. Mist diminished the horizon, brought down the sky until it seemed no more than a few inches above us. As far as the eye could see, not one thing living. The mist lifted to reveal before me an acreage of half-derelict facades of sheer red brick, the vast man-trap, the megalomaniac citadel of his palazzo. It was a world in itself, but a dead one, a burned-out planet. I saw the beast bought solitude, not luxury, with his money. The valet tweaked politely at my sleeve. My lord is waiting. Gaping door and broken windows let the wind in everywhere. We mounted one staircase after another, our feet clopping on the marble. My lord has his eyrie high above the house, a small, stifling, darkened room. He keeps his shutters locked at noon. I was out of breath by the time we reached it and returned to him the silence with which he greeted me. I will not smile. He cannot smile. The valet coughed. To him fell the delicate task of transmitting to me his master's wishes. My master... A stick fell in the grate. The valet started, lost his place in his speech, began again. My master has but one desire. The thick, rich, wild scent with which my lord had soaked himself the previous evening hangs all about us, ascends in cursive blue from the smoke hole of a precious Chinese pot. He wishes only... Now, in the face of my passivity, the valet twittered, his ironic composure gone. He gulped. He swallowed. At last contrived to unleash an unpunctuated flood. My master's sole desire is to see the pretty young lady unclothed, nude, without her dress, and that only for the one time, after which she will be returned to her father undamaged, with banker's orders for the sum which he has lost to my master at cards, and also a number of fine presents, such as fur, jewels, and horses. I remained standing. During this interview, my eyes were level with those inside the mask that now evaded mine, as if, to his credit, he was ashamed of his own request. Desnuda. I could scarcely believe my ears. I let out a raucous guffaw. No young lady laughs like that, my old nurse used to remonstrate. But I did. And do. I made my reply in as exquisite a Tuscan as I could muster. You may put me in a windowless room, sir, and I promise you I will pull my skirt up to my waist, ready for you. But there must be a sheet over my face to hide it. There You can visit me once, sir, and only the once. After that, I must be driven directly to the city and deposited in the public square in front of the church. If you wish to give me money, then I should be pleased to receive it. But you should give me only the same amount of money that you would give to any other woman in such circumstances. How pleased I was to see I struck the beast to the heart. For after a baker's dozen heartbeats, one single tear swelled, glittering, at the corner of the masked eye. A tear. A tear, I hoped, of shame. The tear trembled for a moment, then tumbled down the painted cheek to fall with an abrupt tinkle on the tiled floor. The valet, ticking and clucking to himself, hastily ushered me out of the room. A cell had been prepared for me, windowless, airless, lightless, in the viscera of the palace. The valet lit a lamp for me. What was he doing in my bedroom, this jigging caricature of a man? Was he to be my warder? Am I in such reduced circumstances that I may not have a lady's maid? As if in reply to my unspoken demand, the valet clapped his hands. To assuage your loneliness, madam. A knocking and clattering behind the door of the cupboard, and out glides a soubrette from an operetta, with glossy, nut-brown curls, rosy cheeks, blue, rolling eyes. It takes me a moment to recognize her. She carries a looking-glass in one hand and powder puff in the other, and there is a musical box where her heart should be. She tinkles as she rolls towards me on her tiny wheels. Nothing human lives here, said the valet. My maid halted, bowed. From a split seam at the side of her bodice protrudes the handle of a key. She is a marvelous machine. Click, click. She raises her arm and busily dusts my cheek with pink powdered chalk that makes me cough, then thrusts towards me her little mirror. I saw within it not my own face, but that of my father. What, you self-deluding fool, are you crying still? And drunk, too. He tossed back his grapper and hurled the tumbler away. Then I saw myself, haggard from a sleepless night, pale enough to need my maid's supply of rouge. I heard the key turn in the heavy door and the valet's footsteps patter down the stone passage. Time passed, but I do not know how much. Then the valet woke me with rolls and honey. I gestured the tray away, but he set it down firmly beside the lamp and took from it a little shagreen box, which he offered to me. I turned away my head. Oh, my lady! Such hurt, cracked his high-pitched voice. He dexterously unfastened the gold clasp. On a bed of crimson velvet lay a single diamond earring, perfect as a tear. I snapped the box shut and tossed it into a corner. Very well, said the valet, put out, and indicated it was time for me to visit my host again. You would not think the beast had budged an inch since I last saw him. He sat in his huge chair, with his hand in his sleeves, and the heavy air never moved. The incense rose from the pot. The same fire burned. Take off my clothes for you, like a ballet girl. Is that all you want of me? The sight of a young lady's skin that no man has seen before, stammered the valet. I wish I'd rolled in the hay with every lad on my father's farm to disqualify myself from this humiliating bargain. That he should want so little was the reason why I could not give it. I did not need to speak for the beast to understand me. A tear came from his other eye, and then he moved. He buried his cardboard carnival head in, I would say, his arms. He withdrew his, I might say, hands from his sleeves, and I saw his furred pads, his excoriating claws. The dropped tear caught on his fur and shone. And in my room, for hours, I heard those paws pad back and forth outside my door. When the valet arrived again with his silver salver, I had a pair of diamond earrings of the finest water in the world. I threw the other into the corner where the first one lay. The valet twittered with aggrieved regret. My master, he say, invite the young lady to go riding. He clapped his hands, and my maidservant clicked and jangled into the imitation of life. She rolled towards the cupboard and reached inside it to fetch out my riding habit. Of all things, my very own riding habit that I'd left behind in Petersburg. Our horses, saddled and bridled, beasts in bondage, were waiting for us. Cold that morning, yet dazzling, with the sharp winter sunlight that wounds the retina. A profound sense of strangeness slowly began to possess me. I knew my two companions were not in any way as other men, the simian retainer and the master for whom he spoke. I knew they lived according to a different logic than I had done until my father abandoned me to the wild beasts by his human carelessness. I was a young girl, a virgin, and therefore men denied me rationality, just as they had denied it to all those who were not exactly like themselves in all their unreason. If I could see not one single soul in that wilderness of desolation all around me, then the six of us, mounts and riders both, could boast amongst us not one soul either, since all the best religions in the world state categorically that not beasts nor women were equipped with the flimsy, insubstantial things when the good Lord opened the gates of Eden and let Eve and her familiars tumble out. Understand, then, that though I would not say I privately engaged in metaphysical speculation as we rode through the reedy approaches to the river, I certainly meditated on the nature of my own state, how I had been bought and sold, passed from hand to hand. That clockwork girl who powdered my cheeks for me, had I not been allotted only the same kind of imitative life amongst men that the dollmaker had given her? We came to the bank of the river that was so wide we could not see across it, so still with winter that it scarcely seemed to flow. The horses lowered their heads to drink. The valet cleared his throat. If you will not let him see you without your clothes, I involuntarily shook my head. You must then prepare yourself for the sight of my master naked. The river broke on the pebbles with a diminishing sigh. My composure deserted me. All at once I was on the brink of panic. I did not think that I could bear the sight of him, whatever he was. You, said the valet, must. When I saw how scared he was, I might refuse. I nodded. The reed bowed down in a sudden snarl of wind that brought with it a gust of the heavy odour of his disguise. The valet held out his master's cloak to screen him from me, as he removed the mask. The horses stirred. The tiger will never lie down with the lamb. He acknowledges no pact that is not reciprocal. The lamb must learn to run with the tigers. A great feline tawny shape, whose pelt was barred with a savage geometry of bars, the colour of burned wood. His domed, heavy head, so terrible he must hide it. How subtle the muscles, how profound the tread. The annihilating vehemence of his eyes, like twin suns. I felt myself ripped apart, as if I suffered a marvellous wound. The valet moved forward, as if to cover up his master, now the girl had acknowledged him. But I said, no! The tiger sat still as a heraldic beast, in the pact he had made with his own ferocity to do me no harm. He was far larger than I could have imagined. Nothing about him reminded me of humanity. I, therefore, shivering, now unfastened my jacket, to show him I would do him no harm. I showed his grave silence, my white skin, my red nipples, and the horses turned their heads to watch me also, as if they too were courteously curious as to the fleshy nature of women. Then the beast lowered his massive head. "Enough," said the valet with a gesture. The wind died down. All was still again. Then they went off together, the valet on his pony, the tiger running before him like a hound, and I walked along the riverbank for a while. I felt at liberty for the first time in my life. Then the winter sun began to tarnish. A few flakes of snow drifted from the darkening sky, and when I returned to the horses, I found the beast mounted again on his grey mare, cloaked and masked, and once more, to all appearances, a man. And so we returned to the palace. The valet did not return me to my cell, but instead to an elegant, if old-fashioned, boudoir with sofas of faded pink brocade, a gin's treasury of oriental carpets, tintinnabulation of cut glass chandeliers. Candles struck rainbows from the prismatic hearts of my diamond earrings that lay on my new dressing table, at which my attentive maid stood ready with her powder puff and mirror. I took the looking glass from her hand, but it was in the midst of one of its magic fits again, and I did not see my own face in it, but that of my father. At first, I thought he smiled at me. Then I saw he was smiling with pure gratification. He sat, I saw, at the very table where he had lost me, engaged in counting out a tremendous pile of banknotes. My father's circumstances had changed already, well-shaven, neatly barbered, smart new clothes. The beast had clearly paid clash on the nail for his glimpse of my bosom, and paid up promptly. Then I saw my father's trunks were packed, ready for departure. Could he so easily leave me here? There was a note on the table with the money, in a fine hand. I could read it quite clearly. The young lady will arrive immediately. Some harlot with whom he'd briskly negotiated a liaison on the strength of his spoils? Not at all. For at that moment, the valet knocked at my door to announce that I might leave the palace at any time. When I looked at the mirror again, my father had disappeared, and all I saw was a pale, hollow-eyed girl whom I scarcely recognized. "Leave me alone," I said to the valet. He did not need to lock the door now. I fixed the earrings in my ears. They were very heavy. Then I took off my riding habit. But when I got down to my shift, my arms dropped to my sides. I was unaccustomed to nakedness. I was so unused to my own skin that to take off all my clothes involved a kind of flaying. I thought the beast had wanted a little thing compared with what I was prepared to give him. But it is not natural for humankind to go naked, not since we first hid our loins with fig leaves. He had demanded the abominable. I felt as much atrocious pain as if I was stripping off my own underpelt. Then I was flinching stark, except for his irreproachable tears. I huddled in the furs I must return to him, to keep me from the lacerating winds that raced along the corridors. I knew the way to his den without the valet to guide me. No response to my tentative rap on the door. Then the wind blew the valet whirling along the passage. He must have decided that if one should go naked, then all should go naked. Without his livery, he revealed himself, as I suspected, a delicate creature, covered with silken moth-grey fur, chocolate muzzle, the gentlest creature in the world. The valet bowed me inside the beast's room. The purple dressing gown, the mask, the wig were laid out on his chair. A glove was planted on each arm. The empty house of his appearance was ready for him, but he had abandoned it. There was a reek of fur and piss. The incense pot lay broken in pieces on the floor. A candle stuck by its own grease to the mantelpiece lit two narrow flames in the pupils of the tiger's eyes. He was pacing backwards and forwards, the tip of his heavy tail twitching as he paced out the length and breadth of his imprisonment between gnawed and bloody bones. He will gobble you up. Nursery fears made flesh and sinew, earliest and most archaic of fears, fears of devourment, the beast and his carnivorous bed of bone, and I, white, shaking, raw, approaching him as if offering in myself the key to a peaceable kingdom in which his appetite need not be my extinction. He went as still as stone. He was far more frightened of me than I was of him. I squatted on the wet straw and stretched out my hand. I was now within the field of force of his golden eyes. He snuffled the air as if to smell my fear. He could not. Slowly, he began to drag his gleaming, heavy weight across the floor towards me. A tremendous throbbing, as of the engine that makes the earth turn, filled the little room. He had begun to purr. The sweet thunder of this purr shook the old walls, made the shutters batter the window until they burst apart and let in the white light of the snowy moon. Tiles came crashing down from the roof. I heard them fall into the courtyard far below. The reverberations of his purring rocked the foundations of the house. The walls began to dance. I thought, it will all fall. Everything will disintegrate. He dragged himself closer and closer to me until I felt the harsh velvet of his head against my hand. Then a tongue, abrasive as sandpaper. He will lick the skin off me. And each stroke of his tongue ripped off skin after successive skin, all the skins of a life in the world, and left behind a nascent patina of shining hairs. My earrings turned back to water and trickled down my shoulders. I shrugged the drops off my beautiful fur.
Well, I just wanted to thank everyone on the platform for an absolutely marvellous experience. It felt wonderful to share some sort of intimate recollections of Angela Carter that were, you know, were also brought her alive again as a personality, but fundamentally as a writer, and for that to be followed by her own words, you know, her rendition of Beauty and the Beast. It was just an exceptional opportunity, and thank you so much to Di for being the bridge between the two. I think after hearing so much from Angela Carter, we didn't feel it was really would work to have questions, although I'm sure you're all bursting with questions. So what we're actually going to do is going to take all the speakers off the stage. Colin will do that. We'll take Susanna back to the bookstall where you can talk to her. We've got the book there, which actually do have the postcards, while they do that, perhaps we can just thank Susanna, Hattie, and Di once more.